See, I told you so. Another person that came into my life and experience through Liberty Fund was Peter Stanless. I'd read some of Peter on Burke. In fact, Peter has published more on Burke than anybody alive, I think, actually. At that time, though, his interest was in Frost, Robert Frost, whom he had met and had an enduring friendship with, and who he is now preparing a book, a completed manuscript that soon will be published by ISI. He himself was a graduate of Middlebury College and Breadloaf School of English, and then the University of Michigan. He is one of the founding participants of the Philadelphia Society, early in its very beginning. Published over 100 articles and 7 books, and is become sort of a Frost expert, as it were. He has been at Rockford for how many years? How many years are you at Rockford?
18.
Where he has become a sort of landmark of excellence in their history, too. So I recommend him to you and introduce you to him now, Mr. Lewis.
When one of my friends heard about how much I had published on Edmund Burke, he said to me, "My God, man, you're in a terrible rut." And I had to say, "No, I'm not in a rut. I'm merely well entrenched." Because I think even after all that I have published on Burke, I've only scratched the surface on all that can still be done. I'd like to begin with something of a distinction that I don't believe has been made during this conference, and that is the distinction between culture and civilization. The two are by no means synonymous. I think it probably can be easily demonstrated that what we call culture is derivative from what we call civilization. Civilization is much more concerned with the basic institutions of civil society. I remember once a very dramatic incident that happened at Breadloaf when Robert Frost was giving a poetry reading. I'm sure it was done with deliberate intent to shock the audience, to give them some sort of aesthetic shock, to alert them to something. He threw out a question to the audience: "What is the opposite of utopia?" He got dead silence. So he said it again, more loudly: "What is the opposite of utopia?" Finally, a querulous, squeaky voice from the audience piped up, "Hell?" He said, "No, not hell, civilization." Now, supposing he had said culture instead of civilization, it seems to me that would have taken away the full impact of his rather witty answer, because I think it is true that civilization is the opposite of utopia. Utopian visions are invariably fictional, imaginative constructs, such as Marx would fill out or such as Rousseau filled out, and they are invariably monistic, consumed things that the disciples of the monism hold fast to. And they become enamored of this one idea, whether it's Nazism or communism or fascism. And then, of course, they seek disciples, and once they have enough disciples and feel strong enough, they want to impose it upon society, make society conform to the ideology. Think of the 20th century in these terms. And in effect, what happened in the 20th century, in the two great wars and the conflicts between and in them, millions and millions of innocent people were deliberately butchered by ideologues who simply wanted to impose their system upon civilization, and in the process destroyed civilization without, of course, acquiring or achieving anything like their ideology. Ideology, I think, is one of the great sources of conflict in our time. Many people think of it as synonymous with philosophy. I've heard students say as much. I think ideology is the perversion of philosophy. not the fulfillment of it. Because true philosophy aims at wisdom through knowledge and not just as spinning out fictional concepts that are to be imposed upon society. I remember when I first started reading Burke, I had to read some of his early works that are not very well known, including his summary of English history, which he never completed because David Hume usurped the market. But in that history, Burke attempted to define what he thought were some of the basic elements that comprised European civilization. He came up with three basic ideas. One, he said, was the law, the Roman civil law, the remnants of the Roman civil law that survived the Roman Empire's decline, which had been spread throughout Europe, and which were modified, of course, in different nations, English common law being one modification of it, and so on. So Roman law gave a kind of sanction to the legal norms of society. The other great source of information of civilization, according to Burke, was Christianity, which provided the norm, the moral norms and the aesthetic and spiritual norms for society. And finally, the third group he identified were the Teutonic tribes that had invaded the Roman Empire, whose customs and manners were combined with these various other elements, the Roman law and Christianity, and that most of Europe consisted in its civilization of a combination of those three elements. They varied from nation to nation for various reasons, but basically Burke, I think, was putting his finger on something very fundamental, and that these were the great institutions of society, law, ethics, and the cultural attributes of corporate man. Now, if you look at all of the main institutions of society today, I think almost without exception we can say that they are in a rather sad condition. They have some very serious problems, whether we regard it in terms of the family, or the church, or schools, or the state. If you think of those four basic institutions of civilization, each one of them faces some very serious liabilities. In the family, for example, I think it's been pretty largely subverted by what you might call abstract permissiveness, in which parents are afraid to discipline their children when they do anything wrong. And when they don't combine any kind of discipline with any kind of normative principles, when they bring up their children with complete permissiveness and utter lack of normative principles, I think it's a formula for disaster. And when you carry that over into our schools, of course, the same thing has happened there, where the teachers are not allowed to discipline the students when they step out of line. Now, behind both of these principles, permissiveness and the lack of any kind of normative standards, is, I believe, what has well been described as the belief in the natural goodness of man. Rousseau is, in some respects, the chief advocate of that. He didn't originate it, but he popularized it throughout Europe, that man is by nature good. And if he is by nature good, then you must never discipline him, never bring him into account to any kind of normative principles. And I think that, to a very large extent, that explains the demise of genuine culture in our society. In the 19th century, Matthew Arnold raised the question of culture, and he raised the question, really, of what is the opposite of culture? And his answer was anarchy. His series of essays called Culture and Anarchy are a constant contrast between the forces in civilization that are the result of our culture, and when the culture itself is the result of the norms that are inculcated in people from childhood into maturity through church and state. When these decay, then the culture also decays in that respect. The great growth in absolute power on the part of the state has also, I think, been a part of that. We speak of the collectivism of our times, of the totalitarian systems, and we think, of course, immediately of Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. But to a certain extent, that same principle applies to our democratic system as well. And it combines very frequently with this belief in the sentimental view of human nature, the natural goodness of man, qualified frequently by some nationalistic or ideological concern. And these, I think, are indigenous in our system even today in America. We have a system of government that I don't believe either one of the two major parties can escape from, and that is the bureaucratic state whose main function is what they call distributive justice, but it's really distributive mass mercy, in which justice to the individual is often sacrificed in order to fulfill mass mercy to the electorate who keeps them in power. And I think that neither party really has broken through that to any extent to rectify that kind of situation. One way of looking at culture is trying to see it in terms of its opposite. And if the present lack of cultural system, the debility of culture is the result of a belief in the natural goodness of man, among other things, then of course we have to consider what was the opposite doctrine from that which Rousseau and others helped to subvert. It was, of course, the old Christian doctrine of concerning in human nature, that man is by nature not good, but flawed from birth, and that he has therefore to work very hard to discipline himself to overcome those flaws. And discipline was the result of a belief in overcoming the supposed natural goodness of man, which was actually the natural weaknesses of man. That doctrine was called original sin, and of course there's a great range of interpretations as to exactly what you mean by that, between the total concept of helplessness of human nature in redeeming itself, relying entirely upon divine will in the most extreme of the Augustinian traditions, or the opposite, the more Thomistic theology, which made much more room for human individual establishment in its own salvation. I don't know that there's any way that these matters can be rectified in our own time. I think that the difficulty of restoring culture as our injunction was made for this program is practically impossible, because norms cannot be accepted without those who are outside the norms feeling that they are somehow being tyrannized. If Aristotle's precept is true, that man is by nature a civil, social, political animal, then of course the institutions that contribute to the strength of that have to be preserved. And I think that they cannot be preserved if many members of that society emancipate themselves from those structures and norms, and then, in effect, wish to live in society as though they lived outside of society, as though they lived in a kind of pre-civil state of nature. And I think, to a very large extent, the subculture of our time, the members of that, are pretty largely attempting to live in civil society as though they were still living in a kind of jungle, except that they think of the jungle as a kind of Garden of Eden, not as the Darwinian notion of the survival of the fittest, which was not Darwin's own idea, but rather than something idealistic, a kind of idealization of the primitive life, which is set against the complexities of civilized order. In this respect, it seems to me that we are caught in a terrible dilemma. If we wish to improve our cultural condition, because in each case we would have to have enormous improvements in the institutions of society itself, the basic institutions, which I would say would be the family, the church, the state, and schools. And in each case, as I say, I think that there are problems in all four of these institutions which make it almost impossible to hope for any kind of restoration of a supposed better culture. Now, I don't want to speak as though I have no hope for the future, because I think that to a very large extent there are some forces in our society that are working positively toward that. They are not the dominant forces by any means. Even the Philadelphia Society, I think, is a positive step in this direction. So too is the ISI and Liberty Fund and other such organizations as that, seems to me, are almost like oases in the desert, that they may be the source from which ultimately the nature of man may be redeemed. The one age is like another for the soul. I haven't said anything that you don't already know, I'm sure. But all ages shine in equal darkness as far as the spirit is concerned, unless the spirit is led by sound leadership. And I think that's the great lack in the 20th century, the lack of sound leadership. When you look at the kind of leaderships that emerged in the 20th century, it's almost horrendous to contemplate such human beings as Adolf Hitler and Stalin to lead whole nations and civilizations to the kind of destruction that the 20th century experienced. We are still, I think, involved in some of the confusions that brought about these conditions in the first place. I think a lot of our thinking is monistic, and we think of it in terms of a single solution to a complex problem that often has its opposites. The dualistic philosophy, which sets good against evil, or the true against the false, the beautiful against the ugly, that becomes diminished to the extent that we believe only one kind of reality holds firm in determining the course of human events. The book that I'm working currently on, Robert Frost, which is almost completed, is concerned with his dualism, how his dualism is reflected in, certainly in his poetry, but also in his conception of education, his view of society, his view of politics. Separate chapters to each of these subjects indicate the extent to which they are filled, they fill his philosophical views with that kind of understanding of a thing in itself and then also its opposite. Without that kind of dualism, I don't think judgment or good taste is possible, and we need to have much more awareness of the dualities in human affairs before we can hope to have any kind of restoration of our cultural inheritance. I'm not sure that there's much sign of hope for that, but I think it's among the directions that we have to take as a civilization if we are to redeem ourselves into the future. Thank you.